Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview proven entrepreneurs for an audience of entrepreneurs. And my goal has always been to interview people, have audience of entrepreneurs listen, build their businesses while they listen, and then come back here and do an interview about how they did it. Kind of continue what I called years ago the circle of Mixergy. And today we've got a pair of entrepreneurs who are continuing that circle. They listen to these interviews. They built up this business based on their understanding that boarding schools have a problem. In fact, they said, we don't even know that we're going to go after boarding schools. We're going to look around and see who has a problem, who has a pain that we could alleviate. And they considered a bunch of different businesses. Then they looked at boarding schools. They discovered that boarding schools had a pain. They started building, well, not software, prototype. The fact that it wasn't real software caused them one little bit of problem that we'll hope we'll talk about. But it was a needed enough issue. It solved a bit or addressed a big enough pain that they started getting customers and they built up their business. And here they are today to talk about how they did it. The two founders are Kurt Meyer. And Kurt, you should probably raise your hand, even though most people will be listening. And can you say hi?
Hey, guys.
Cool. And the other founder is Paul Organ. Paul, can you raise your hand and say hi?
Hello.
Hey. So they kind of sound alike, but and frankly, are you guys wearing the same shirt today, too?
Long sleeve,
short sleeve. Hey, you guys are like brothers in this business.
Yeah, I just realized when the camera came on that, yeah, we look like we just said.
Well, the company they founded is called Boarding, where it makes running boarding schools, or it helps boarding schools run more safely and more efficiently. I invited them here to talk about how they did it. And to make that happen, we've got two great sponsors. The first will help you manage your email right. It's called ActiveCampaign. And the second will help you get more developers. It's called TopTal. I'll talk about both those later. First, guys, how much revenue can you make with this software? What's your annual revenue right now?
You want to see that?
Sure.
So we're now at 1.2 million in ARR.
Annual recurring revenue of 1.2 already. Okay.
Yeah. And did you say how much we can make? Is that what the
question is? I just want to get a sense of where you guys were with this. And you started the business in 2013. So that's solid growth, all bootstrapped? Or no, you got a little outside funding?
Yeah.
How much did you raise?
750 in total.
Okay. Are we talking U.S. dollars here, by the way?
New Zealand dollars.
New Zealand dollars. What? So let me see. 1.2 New Zealand dollars to U.S. is how much? That comes out to about a million, right? A little under a million U.S. dollars a year.
Yeah. There's also about 200,000 in non-recurring.
Yeah.
In addition to that, you're saying 200,000 in non-recurring.
Yep.
Not bad for a couple of guys who as kids started out selling sunglasses. Kurt, how did you sell? You both sold them separately. How did you do it when you were younger?
Yeah. Well, I grew up on an island in the Pacific, so there's not many sort of like career paths to go through. So a lot of people end up like starting their own businesses, like my parents and, you know, sort of thing. I would just import glasses from the States and sell them to tourists at the market. That's pretty much what I did.
And as they came in, you would just stand there. At what age were you standing around selling sunglasses?
I think 10 was probably the youngest I was, but I continued that for like a few years and bought my first car.
You bought your first car by selling sunglasses to tourists?
Yeah.
Wow. What'd you do to get them to buy? What'd you do to stand out? Did you have any techniques?
I'm a terrible salesperson. But I think, what did I do to get them to buy? I don't know. I just set up a stall and, you know, gave them the glasses, you know, got them to try it on and things like that.
It was just standing there every day and getting them to try it on.
Pretty much. But it was only one day a week or the occasional fruit ship that would come in.
Okay. All right. And then, Paul, you did the same thing?
It is weird, actually. My friend used to import them. My parents aren't small business owners or anything. So my friend would do basically what Kurt was doing, importing them. And then I would buy them off him cheaper than what he would sell them at the market. Same thing. Markets with tourists was the exact same sort of demographic. And then I would just sell them with a markup, really. And then I just used that money to go to Australia for the first time.
To go to Australia for the first time.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the two of you, as I understand it, met in boarding school, right?
No. We went to architecture school together.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in architecture school, how do you end up with software?
Architecture is a funny degree because you can get away with doing a lot of different things. So we were doing more software stuff than like designing buildings. And we found that to be like, very interesting. Mm. And we also discovered after 3 years that architects don't actually make that much money in general.
Yes.
And so that kind of was a problem for us. And we had this research scholarship that we were doing that had that was based on using software to improve, architectural design decisions.
Yep.
And that was cool. And our tutor said that, this could be a thing. So that, we got excited and we wanted to try that out. And we ended up leaving architecture school to sort of do that.
Yeah. And I remember specifically, part of the scholarship was we had to do 200 hours and you get paid, the money to do that. And I remember, honestly, it was probably 40 hours worth of work and they were still like blown away. And in architecture school, it's the opposite. You do like 1,000 hours worth of work and they just go, meh. So it was like the opposite effect. And I just remember being like, wow, there seems to be, like, I guess that was just intuition speaking at that. It was kind of like this, there seems to be something more in this area.
And what was it about your work that after 40 hours blew away the professor?
I think it was just when I looked at it, I think they just didn't see anything like this or in the architecture school. So it was like my work, Kurt's was much better than my work, but he was still impressed by my work. So that's why I was kind of like, whoa, like I'm not even good at this and I didn't really spend much time doing it. So how come I'm getting $5,000 for this? Yeah. They just didn't see it in architecture school very much.
And what the software did was help people find real estate, right?
Basically, yeah. Using big data, you put in the criteria that you're looking for and it'll show you the properties that match that.
Yep. It was a lot like Trulia at the time. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. And you were just doing this as a project. You said, hey, this is exciting. This is actually working. Maybe we need to shift the direction of our lives here together. And somewhere around then, you met a guy named Sam Ubbins. Mm-hmm. He is also from New Zealand. He's blown up, become really popular. He owns consulting.com, which gives him a ton of credibility. He teaches a lot of people how to become consultants. And you guys said, hey, he's in our town. We want to go see him. How far away from you did he live, Paul?
Yeah, he just 2 minutes up the street. Literally, the office that we're in right now was his office and his house was upstairs.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you just said, I want to get to know this guy. He lives in my town. He's not too far away. I'm going to walk over and see him.
Oh, I LinkedIn messaged him. And I was surprised because at that point, in New Zealand, being famous from being an entrepreneur is not really a thing. I mean, it is getting good now, but I thought he was like some sort of celebrity. So I messaged him on LinkedIn and got a response within like 10 minutes. I remember him being like, whoa. And then he did delay our meeting, me, Kurt, and him, for like a root canal or something. And so I was like, oh, well, I'm getting blown off. Like, he's a celebrity, so fair enough. And then we met him like not long after that. And he just a normal dude. Yep.
And one of the things that I heard blew you away was his age. How old was he at the time that you guys met him?
Yeah, he was 23. And there's a market just down the street from where we are right now. And I was walking with my girlfriend who knows Sam's sister quite well. And she said, look, that's where sort of Sam lives. And if you're standing outside right now looking up at this, you'd be like, well, that's like a New York sort of loft kind of. And there's not many buildings like this in the country probably. And so I remember looking up being like, how old is Sam again? And then my girlfriend said, yeah, he's like 23. And I was 21 at the time. And I was kind of like, yeah, I'm doing something wrong.
You're saying, look, being an architect is not what we thought it was going to be. Creating software is actually more rewarding and is faster than doing the architectural work that we had in mind. Then you're meeting Sam. You're seeing what's possible if you get into entrepreneurship. You start putting all this together. Sam's the guy who introduced you to Mixergy interviews too?
Yeah.
And to this philosophy of don't come up with an idea, but look for somebody's pain.
Yep, exactly.
How did he communicate that to you, and why would he bother teaching you that?
I don't know why he bothered teaching us. Maybe it's because we're similar to him.
Yeah. Sorry to go. I remember now. So basically, Kurt and I saw the Mixergy interview, and we were doing the real estate thing, but we didn't know about venture capital, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of like, and by the way, we were living using student allowance, which is like basically a government payout. We had dropped out of school, but kept paying to the end of the semester. So like that was literally what we had to get by on. And we're building this real estate thing. And I remember we were kind of like, well, how is this ever going to make us money? We found Sam's interview on Mixergy. He talked about the whole process. And then we went out and actually started doing it. So that when we talked to Sam, hey, we've already got five of these people that want it. And I think that made us stand out, I guess, out of everyone that was contacting him, because he was like, oh, well, these guys are actually doing it. Plus, they live 2 minutes away.
Yes.
Right.
And we had two pre-sales by the time we got to Sam as well.
Two pre-sales. All right. So before we get into the pre-sale part, you had to figure out who to pre-sell, who to understand and empathize with and get their problem, right? So what are some of the industries that you guys considered when you were looking to do that pain extraction process on them?
I guess real estate was the most obvious one because we were already trying stuff in there. I think we also considered insurance. Fortunately, we came up with boarding school pretty early before testing out a whole bunch of markets. Mm. But we still had that criteria validation when we went into it.
Yep.
So why wasn't real estate a good market for you to look into? There's a lot of money in real estate. You guys have enough experience there to have the credibility to have conversations with people there. Why not real estate?
The part of it was, we didn't want to copy Sam exactly. But I think we also, like Kurt went to boarding school. I went to a boarding school, but I didn't board. And so we could get a pretty quick access to the leaders at those schools. I mean, we weren't terrible students at high school, so they didn't shoo us away. So we could get an interview with them pretty quickly, yeah.
It's that you had more access to them. It's not that they were a better market necessarily than real estate.
Yeah.
How do you go to boarding school and not have to board? You can do that.
Oh, yeah, you can. Yeah, actually, in all boarding schools, you can do that. But my school was primarily a normal school with a boarding component, yeah.
Okay. And why were you in boarding school? Were you like a rich kid whose parents wanted to go tour around the country, Kurt?
No, not at all. So I think there's a different type of boarding school in New Zealand to, over in the US. And in New Zealand, we have public boarding schools, which aren't sort of rich kid schools at all. So that's the one that I went to. As I mentioned before, I grew up in the island, so school over there is pretty limited. So I had to come to New Zealand to become an architect, or so I thought.
All right. So you're starting to make phone calls. You're starting to go in. Who's the first person in the boarding school that you went to talk to? There we go. The connection was, boy, we got a weird connection today. Who's the first person that you guys went to talk to understand what pains they had so you can figure out what to create?
I think it might have been the one at my school, was it? Mr. Morton, Peter Morton. So at my school, the head of boarding there was my basketball coach, or one of the managers, yeah.
And so you walked in and you said, hey, I've got this. Actually, how? What was the premise for you going in and talking to him?
This is like tactical replication. Like we just took quick question, the quick question email, and
strange question.
That's the one that Dane Maxwell wrote, and a bunch of people have used. You sent him an email that said strange question. That gets them to open the email, and then what is this strange question in the email? Now that you've got their attention, what's the question?
It was just, is there anything that's, slowing you down or keeping you up at night in the day-to-day runnings of the boarding school? And in hindsight, that's kind of weird because I knew him. Like,
It is kind of weird because now he's got to hit reply and think through all his pain points and bring them up. And most people aren't aware of them. The better approach would have been to do what?
Call them probably.
Say, hey, I'm a former student of yours. Can I come in and spend some time with you? I'm a former student who has a need to start a business for boarding schools. Can I sit down with you and understand what you're going through? Yeah, that would have worked. Did he actually hit reply on the email that you sent over?
He did. Not my one, not my housemaster. So I had to call him, and then he said, yeah, just come in.
Yeah.
Okay, so for Kurt, it was actually walking in and having a conversation. For you, Paul, when you sent the email saying, hey, were there any issues, did your headmaster respond with any issues?
He's like, and I don't mean this in an offensive way, but he's like a military guy kind of. He was just like, sure, call me.
So in both cases, you ended up on phones regardless of your approach. Why don't we start with you, Paul? What did you learn on the call? How did you guide the call, and what did you learn from that conversation?
Like you said, they don't actually know what their pains are.
Right.
So I think a lot of people would get discouraged with like them maybe saying, no, we're doing things fine. Like, it's all good. There's, some issues with this. So maybe the guiding part was when anything that was kind of like hinted at a pain, like, oh, there is issues with, yada, yada, but they kind of dust it off. Then you try and like dive into that and dive further and further. But they just try to, if someone said, what's wrong with your business right now? I'd probably be like, it feels pretty good. There's things that we need to work on.
Right.
But when I say like, oh, hey, the sales guys could be doing this better, that's an opportunity to jump in and start to like focus on that. So, listening for those cues, I guess, was...
So however you get them to talk about their day, what you're looking for is for them to start complaining, for them to show a little anxiety, and then you dive in, and then you start to understand a little bit further. Kurt, how did your conversation go?
It was similar, but to be honest, like all the features that we kind of promised, well, not promised, but sort of developed around their initial feedback, my school at least didn't even use those features. So I think those initial conversations are very, very surface level, and it's hard to, like, I wouldn't base your entire product around that necessarily.
Yep.
But I think the key question that we did ask was, are you willing to pay for this? And the answer was yes.
In both cases. And when you say this, what was the this that they would be willing to pay for?
That's true. It was basically an electronic lead system.
An electronic lead system?
Leave.
Yeah, I noticed that as I was going through your website. A lot of the feature pages referred back to leave. Leave is where a student who is boarding at the school wants to go home or wants to go somewhere for a weekend or a day, and the boarding school has that much trouble keeping track of who should get a lead, who should not, when they should get it, so on. Yes?
Yeah.
Because how did they keep track of it before?
Just paper forms, really. Mm-hmm. And you need to get parents to approve it. You need to get the host to approve it. Everything needs to be signed off and stored, documented.
Yep.
And so, this,
so that was the one big pain point. Too many people having to keep track of it. A lot of it being done by paper, and it's too tough to manage. And that became the big thing, so much so that if you said, would you pay for a solution? They said yes. All right. Before I find out what you guys did with that problem, which is surprising, were you surprised by that? I was when I looked through your site.
We actually went a little bit further than I guess maybe Sam talked about in that process. We sort of did emails out, I remember as well. So once we got those first calls, they were like, these are the problems. So we'd email out to as many boarding schools as we can, saying, headline like, is leave a problem, or is finding your kids a problem, whatever. And then we could see the open rates, and so we were like, okay, this is making people open the emails. And then they would reply saying, yeah, that's a pain in the ass or whatever. We just sort of took that and tested it immediately with MailChimp. That's right.
Interesting. MailChimp told you what to create because of the open rates on the headlines that you sent out on the subject lines.
Yeah.
And how do you get all those email addresses of boarding schools?
They're just online. They're just online. So
you scrape it? You do it yourself?
We at the beginning, we did it all ourselves. Yeah.
You just went online, you started copying and pasting their email addresses from their websites and sending out email to them.
Yep.
Dozens of schools or hundreds?
Ooh, it was probably hundreds.
Hundreds.
In the beginning, we only focused on New Zealand, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, we did send out some to Australia as well. I might be getting my times wrong.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, but yeah. I've got a sense of it now. All right, have conversations with people. Discover this pain point that I don't think outsiders would have understood, which is that leave and managing leave is such a big issue that administrators would be willing to pay for it. Then validate that by starting to send out email more broadly to people who you couldn't walk into their office and ask questions. Based on the open rates, you're starting to identify a pain point and you know that people are starting to want to pay. Let me take a moment, talk about my sponsor, and then come back in and move on to the next part of your story, see what you did with it. The sponsor is actually a competitor of MailChimp. How dare you guys bring up a competitor of my sponsor? No, it's ActiveCampaign. And truthfully, if all you want to do is send out an email and see who's opening and closing, MailChimp is fine. Here's where there's a problem with it. And with other basic email providers, we don't just want to send out email, the same email to everybody. We don't just want to keep track of open rates. What we want to do is be smart about it. Send out email to a broad group of people, watch what they click, and based on what they click or don't click, send follow-up messages. For example, if you were a business that addressed both administrators and students, you don't want to send the same email. Imagine if, or you know what, let's not say students. Let's suppose that you guys wanted to go after parents, because you know the parents can drive some of the software decisions at the school because they're on PTA boards or other advisory roles, and you want to go to administrators. Well, if someone's on your website and they're checking out the administrator part of your website, you want to start adding them to the administrator funnel and know that you're addressing them like an administrator. But if they're a parent, you want to send them a different set of emails and address them like a parent and maybe arm them with some swipe files and emails and suggestions for how they can get their school to manage their leave more efficiently and use your software to protect their students more. So that's basic, right? They, based on where they are and what they sign up for, you start to categorize them. But what if they don't do that? What if they just come to your site, add to their email address to your mailing list? Well, there, based on what they're clicking, you can start to tell, this is a parent, keeps clicking on parent stuff. Let's bucket them into the parent sequence and start following up with them like a parent instead of like a general recipient. Or maybe they're watching all the videos on your website about how your software could be used for parents. Then you tag them. Maybe they're looking at different blog posts that are geared towards administrators. You tag them based on that, and then you start to shift your marketing. All right, all this sounds really complicated and sounds like a pain in the butt, and frankly, with a lot of other software, it would be. Here, with ActiveCampaign, what you've got is software that makes that super simple. I mean, really, you will actually use these features, because I'm going to give you 2 free one-on-one sessions with experienced consultants who will make sure that you implement this. And more importantly, once you start seeing the numbers go up, once you say, hey, this is an idea that actually makes sense, but I don't have time for it, and you see that you implement it fast, and then you get numbers, real sales based on real categorization, then your mind starts to go in all different directions of how much you can use this powerful software. Am I doing too much talking, guys? Maybe. Let me bring this at home. All right. Anyone who wants to go try this should go test this out for free. Go to activecampaign.com/mixergy. In the top right, you're going to see a try it for free button. You're going to be able to hit it and try it for free. If you like the software and sign up, I'm going to give you one. I'm not giving them jack. ActiveCampaign is going to give you the second month free after you sign up. They're going to give you, as I said earlier, 2 free one-on-one sessions with their people. And if you happen to use MailChimp or anyone else, they're lovely people over there. They're great software for the masses. But if you're a real marketer, it's not for you. ActiveCampaign will migrate you for free if you use this special URL, activecampaign.com/mixergy. And frankly, if you're using a competitor or think that what I'm saying is not right for you, I still want you to understand why you should be considering this. When you go to activecampaign.com/mixergy, just mouse over the features list and start to look at some of them. You're going to see gifts that explain each one of them in a way that you as a business owner, you as a marketer, you as an entrepreneur are going to freaking salivate over it. ActiveCampaign.com/mixergy. All right. So you did it. You figured out what people say they're willing to pay for, but you don't want to leave it there. The reason that Sam was so impressed is that you started to pre-sell. Talk to me about what your pre-sell process was like.
So the first one was, I think cold called one of the schools and asked them they would be interested in paying up front. And we said, yeah. And that was like, what, one of the first like three schools that we tried calling. And
was that like a holy crap moment? I can't believe it. They said they're actually paid. Yeah.
We were looking at each other like, this is going to be so easy. Yeah. We just got someone to, like, literally cold call, hey, we got this thing. You guys need some money, don't you? Yeah. And then send the money that day into Kurt's bank account because we didn't have a business bank account.
Wow.
And we were like, man, this is going to be so easy. Every school in the world. Yeah.
How much did you ask for?
It wasn't much. Our pricing model at that stage was $2 per student per month. Yeah. And yeah, we've changed it since then. So it only worked out to be like $500.
Yes.
Yeah, $500 bucks a month.
No.
$500 total.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah. Why do you think they said yes to you at the time? They didn't know who you were. You didn't have a website. Why did they say yes?
Well, we just talked. Yeah. I just remember talking purely about the pain point. And like, again, in hindsight, it was probably a terrible call. But I remember just reiterating, hey, but you know, this is surely a pain, right? Yeah. 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 And I think he was kind of like, yeah, I get it. Like, it's a pain. Like, what the heck's the point of this call? And then I remember being like, well, we're building something for it, but we don't have anything to show you, or we don't have anything right now. Yeah. But this is what it is, and this is sort of like started motoring through what it can do. And then he was just kind of like, okay. And I was like, would you sign up for it? And he's just like, yeah. So how do I do this kind of thing? And that's when we were, yeah, really like,
I think David Cohen called that twisting the knife, the investor from Techstars. He said, when you find the pain that they experience, twist the knife, make them feel it even more. And then, all right, that's how you got your first pre-sale. How'd you get your second one?
So that was my school that I went to. So that's a bit of a biased one. But basically once he saw our first prototypes and how it worked and, you know, he was involved in the whole feedback process, we said, yeah, this, you know, you'd be willing to pay for it up front and we'll give you a discount, which they still have. And yeah, wrote some checks.
That's who signed up. So now you got school number two. There was another school that you showed this PDF prototype, as you call it, to this day feels a little bit hurt by. What happened? What did you show them and what happened?
I think that was that Max? Yeah, it was one of the, we basically showed the PDF and they were kind of like, yeah, like how do we sign up? And then we're like, oh yeah, it's a PDF. Like we still need to get started. So we kind of needed money to get started. And that was how that happened. Actually, I remember now, there was another case. We took in a PDF and that school did not sign up with us. Because we were just a couple of early 20-year-olds and we were drenched in rain. We didn't have cars. We bussed in, covered in rain, like casual clothing, and this was like a proper boarding school, so they're like, you know, suits and ties, and we went to like their boardroom and we showed them it, and they were like clicking on it, like half the things were working because it was PDA, and they were like, why isn't this working, why? And we're like, yeah, it's a prototype, kind of sweating. I remember being like, oh my gosh. And then they're like, yeah, it's really buggy because they didn't get the concept, because it looked so real but it just didn't work properly, because we could design, because that was the architecture skills we had. And so it looked really real, but like only like a few buttons worked because it was just a prototype. And so they were pissed. I remember them kind of being like, yeah, I mean, it's great, but it barely works. So, and then we told them the price, which back then was very small, and they kind of laughed us out. And I guess now in hindsight, it was a product that barely worked, and it makes sense why they laughed us out. So
it's kind of painful though, because It's almost like they're treating you like you're a scam artist or something, trying to pass off software that doesn't exist. But in a software world, we're used to this.
Yeah. I mean, even Elon Musk does that still, you know? Like,
yeah.
Is the Model 3 coming out in 3 years?
But the big takeaway is, look, with these types of clients, you have to explicitly say, this is not working software. This is what we're building.
Yeah.
How many pre-sales did you get before you actually started building the software?
Just two.
Yeah. All right. So that was enough to say, we validated this. We have enough data. Let's get going. Who coded the software?
Just to step back a bit. So we only got two, but we had a lot of sort of people helping us develop it. Hmm. But the thing was that we didn't realize at the time is that boarding schools have all these budgets and, you know, finance officers and people that like the people that we were designing it with didn't necessarily hold the purse strings.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until later on that we actually realized that. So they didn't actually have the authority to give us money.
Yeah.
And there's a whole process that we had to like learn about and sort of design our sales process around before we learned how to sell it to them properly. So I think that's mainly why we're getting
Exactly.
So you were starting, it wasn't that people didn't want this, it's just that they just can't pay for it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And Kurt's school actually paid us like a few thousand. It wasn't like the small, as small as the one that we did prior to that. And I think maybe for anyone out there that's going to start a company in the enterprise space, like just know that, yeah, you're unlikely to get much money out up front. And it's not like, say, for instance, SAMZAP, which is property inspections, where it's like a solo, you'll have solo operators a lot, so they can pay for that kind of thing. We had like, we were going through basically a bureaucratic process. So
yeah.
We were just, yeah.
One of the most bureaucratic processes, it right?
Yep.
All right. So you're starting to build it. Who builds it? Who codes up the first version?
We recruited another friend of mine from, boarding school.
Yeah.
Yep.
You went to him, and the deal that you made him was what?
We offered him a percentage of the company. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And a little bit of money. Very little money.
Yeah. Very little money.
Was this like $50 a week? Is that what it was?
Yeah. So
you know what?
So
even when I saw that, I thought maybe it's $50 an hour. But even $50 an hour looked too small. But for $50 a week, this developer coded up the first version of your software?
Yeah. And we're still grateful to this day for that. We were taking nothing, and we were getting student allowance, which again is not like we're not pro there. We're not telling people to go out and get student allowance and build a business, but that was just enough for us to get, you know, live basically.
Right. Now you had a real product and you went back out and you started cold calling schools again. Cold calling for you meant what? Literally picking up the phone and calling, or walking in the rain and coming in drenched into a school?
No, we cold emailed as much as we could to try and get some responses, but then we would follow up with a phone call, and we just dial down the list pretty much, and then we'd try and get a demo online, because we started to sell overseas very quickly, because you have to from New Zealand, and then basically once we got that demo, then we would show them the product, and I think sometimes the prototype, yeah.
Hmm.
All right, and you're starting to get sales. How long did it take before it was significant sales?
I remember when we first started, our sort of holy grail was $20,000 a month.
MRR.
And I think we hit that November 2015.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably the point where we're just
a couple of years after you hatched this idea, you finally hit that number.
Yeah.
How do you live until that point? What do you do for money?
So what happened is we, in that 2013, when we started the company, we didn't really have anything. So we officially incorporated the company and probably started working on it full time around 2014. And then a year later, we raised some capital. And so that was able to pay us. Again, we only took, you can ask our investors, we took like $500 a week. So to an investor, they're like, these guys are the best ever.
You only took what? You're saying you only took $500 a week salary for each of you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay.
And so that was enough for us to get by again, just. But prior to that, we were,
we did web consulting. So there was another guy. So this used to be a shit office space, and we used to work with another guy on websites and marketing and things like that.
Yeah.
Which
I think Paul was doing tech support for a university, Auckland University. Am I right?
I did that. But
that was you, Kurt. Okay.
I think about that job when we, left university.
Oh yeah, true. You dropped out. Yeah,
yeah. That sort of web consulting stuff came up to about $300 a week.
Okay. Wow. You guys could get by on very little money. You then have your software. You're starting to close sales. One of the things that's innovative, that's interesting for me, is that you went iPad first because.
Yeah, they carry around clipboards right now, and so it was just putting a digital clipboard in their hands. In hindsight, a phone would have been just as good, if not better. But we were kind of, I guess, again, our demographic as well, kind of older people. That was a bigger screen for them to see more information on one screen was preferable. They didn't have to, like, start swiping through and, you know, clicking buttons and stuff like that. So just one screen where they could see everything was more preferable to them. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, you knew these aren't people who are sitting at their desk all day the way that, frankly, I, Andrew Warner, am. It's a bunch of people who are running around, a bunch of kids, and so they need something that's more mobile. All right, you did something that just a shock, not that shocking, but man, that must have been a pain in the butt. I'm going to come back and talk to you about that in a moment. But first, I've got to tell you and everyone else that if you don't have a friend who's willing to work for $50 an hour and, no, $50 a week, and frankly, and what you want is the best of the best developers, there's only one place on the entire planet where you can go do that. All right, let's be honest, more than one place. You can, frankly, you can go to Google's offices and you can start seeing if you could hire away people from there, but that's tough. If you can't go into Google's office, eat their food for free and try to recruit their people away, here's the second best thing. Go to TopTal. The reason is TopTal has the best of the best developers in their network. When you're ready to hire, you can just hire any, you can tell them what you're looking for and they'll introduce you to a developer who can do it. If you want, you can start hiring them and getting started pretty quickly, often within days. And if you don't, you just walk away and it doesn't cost you anything other than a phone call. All right. Here's the URL. If you want to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. I'm really zipping through this ad, aren't I? I got to slow it down. Anyway, here it is. Top is in top of your head. Tal is in talent. That's TOPTAL.com/MixerG. You manually updated every kid's name into your software. There was no way for the schools to update it themselves.
Yeah, it was worse than that. Like every school had a different version of the iPad app, which had its own hard-coded database.
They would send you the students and say, look, you deal with this, and you would sit and upload it to their software.
Yeah, so we would recreate. So we would generate a build just for that school with those students loaded. And then we'd send them the IPA file, which they then had to install using the UDID number and all that sort of thing.
Whoa.
Because we weren't on the App Store, so we had to do it all through email.
Why weren't you in the App Store?
We weren't on the App Store. Well, we didn't even have really we didn't have a database or an API to connect to.
This is real amateur stuff, and still.
Yeah, it's super amateur.
You told our producer, look, the fact that they were willing to do this, jump through these hoops to install it, the fact that they were willing to send us the list of students and have us manually do it, the fact that it was so clunky and they still used it was validation that we hit on a pain that was big enough that this product was needed.
Yep. Well, we were doing that all around the world, like sending them, like an install to someone in America, I remember, or Australia, hey, install the app. And that was for a trial, like even setting up a trial. So I guess if you're watching there as well, like the time it's taking for us to get here, it might seem long, but we didn't know anything. Like there was nothing, like we weren't software people at all. And from that story, even our developer, our first developer, he didn't know how to set up Amazon. He didn't know how to do like half these things. And so we just kept pushing through because of the pain.
And so the first sales process was cold call, cold email, the works. When you got a little more sophisticated, what was the next sales process? How did you evolve it to close more deals?
I guess we always wanted to stay remote because like we knew that we're going to have to sell overseas. So even if we had a school within our own city, we would try as hard as we could to just keep the whole sales process on the phone through webinars and demo, then trial, and then close. So we'd go cold call, demo, trial, and then close. But as we got a bit further, a bit more known, we had people come through the website, and they would just opt in, and then we'd do a demo, that way. Info pack as well. Like again, I think that was something that we took from Sam. We just had an info pack online, which people would download, and then we'd follow up with them, as much as we could as well to get a demonstration and then trial.
You know what? I saw that on an early version of your site. And I didn't know what that meant. There was a big clear link for information pack. What was that? What comes it? So people would come in there, they would hit the link. I guess you would ask them for their email address.
Yeah.
And it was just your way of telling them what the software was about.
Yeah, exactly. Like we sort of justified it by our clients like to go and print something and give it to the rest of their, team. And so, they would put in their email address, print it out. And to be honest, I think there was a bit of pre-selling in that as well. Like there was features in there that I don't think we had yet. And so they would take that and then go, hey, guys, like, this is it. And then they do a demo. So,
all right. The other thing that you did was send out physical mail. I know Sam Ovens is really big on that.
Yeah.
I still, you know what? So in my interview with him, I signed up for his consulting course. And a little while later, I got this big envelope in the mail. And sure enough, just like he says, when it's a big freaking envelope, oddly shaped, you can't help it open. I go, what the hell is this? So I open it up and it was a garbage can, which is something that he said that he uses. And I think there might have even been like a fake bill in the garbage can and a note that said, hey, Andrew, you're wasting your money if you don't do whatever it was that he was suggesting. And whatever he was suggesting was refer his program to a friend.
Yeah.
A handful of those things that he sent me.
So yeah, we tried a few, and I think in hindsight, the best one was just a classic sales letter, just a normal typed up letter, because they're getting emails all the time. Again, this is hindsight, so it's easier to understand, but they're getting emails all the time. So, and from parents and students and stuff to say, hey, can I go home? All that kind of thing. And so they get like a letter that's, you know, handwritten on the outside and stamped and everything. And they open it up and it's like the headline would be, hey, like, how are you keeping track of your kids? Or do you know where your kids are? Kind of thing. And they're kind of like, what? And then they read through it. And then they'll like, and this is like classic direct mail response rates. Like you get nothing on the sample size that we were sending. You get no responses, but then we follow up and there's a much higher chance that they've read it than an email that was showing up when they've got hundreds from parents.
So you're not waiting for them to go to your site and sign up. You're just using this to warm them up for when you call.
Yeah. And like, again, like, there's so many things you could have done better if you had a more macro level strategy for it to fit into. But back then we were just desperate. So I remember you type stuff up. We tried the whole 10 pages. We even sent a teddy bear once to a bunch of our schools to say, hey, like 20,000 boarders in Australia wake up every day missing their family. You know, why don't you create a way for them to connect with their parents easier or something like along those lines?
Yep. And yeah, I think physical mail campaign that we sent that actually got us in touch with one of the most prestigious schools in the world was a teacup, and the tagline was high security. And with a, you know, it was all packaged nicely, and the teacup and the saucer were like quite nice, and it had a good sales letter and everything. But yeah, that's turned out to be quite a successful campaign.
Should we tell you about the lemon story?
What's a lemon story?
Like Sam Ovens will love this one too, because he was a part of that. So we had the biggest school in New Zealand and like probably our favorite sort of test case in New Zealand, because they were much like your boarding schools in the States. They're big and prestigious and very secure. And we had lost them to our competitors, but we didn't really ever get a peek in them. So we got no chance to have our demo. And then we also heard, because of Kurt's uncle that worked there, that they were charging like some ridiculous rate. And we're like, no, like we can't let this happen. And I remember like, honestly, I was stressing. We don't like losing. And so I was just like freaking out and was sweating profusely. And then I was with Sam and Kurt was there as well. And then Sam was just like, why don't you send them something? And then we were like, what could change their mind? And we came up with a lemon. So we sent an actual piece of fruit, a lemon, in a direct mail package, like a same day postage to the head of boarding and the deputy principal actually. And that, like, again, in hindsight, that is like really risky. Like these guys are very proper. And all it said was it had a lemon, and then it had a letter underneath it saying, Dan, we'd hate for you to choose a lemon. And then said, hey, just so you know, we're a software company down the street from you, like literally not far from you. And we've got all these clients in these different countries, and these guys also took a look at our competitors and ultimately went with us. And we listed them out. And then we sent it, and we were both like shit scared because they didn't get back to us and respond to anything, no emails, nothing. We're like, oh, we've lost them. Like, it's screwed. We've also pissed them off. And then a couple of months later, it was just like hey, can we get a demo? Like, very no pipe or nothing. It was just, hey, can we get a demo? And we were like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah. No reference to the lemon or anything. They just wanted the demo, and then they switched to you?
Yeah, well, we found out later that the guy's daughter was actually sick, so he used the lemon to make tea and lemon for her. Yeah. So I think it was useful in that case. But, yeah, they weren't offended by it at all.
No.
I was lucky.
But we got to do the pitch, and then we went in, and we were like, again, I was very scared because we hadn't done anything. We were in a boardroom. Like, they had, I don't know how many people there. And, yeah, we just pitched it. And then that day, they were like, we're getting out of our contract with the other company and we're going to go with you guys.
Wow. So this stuff does work, even with your very proper customer base.
Well, I think that the key learnings was, and it's in a Dan Kennedy book, is like, You know, if your house is on fire, you don't care if someone breaks in to tell you, right? Because your house is on fire, you're going to die. So it's like, if the pain is bad enough and you're harassing them, but what you're providing is genuine value and solving that problem, then yeah, you can basically do whatever it takes to get them to notice you.
So the first problem you discovered was leave. People, your potential customers wanted to know who needed to go on leave, who shouldn't be allowed to, et cetera. Later on, you discovered that safety was the next big issue. How did you discover that, and what does that mean for your business? Maybe you guys could get a little closer on camera when you answer. Yeah.
The next big issue, I think, at least what I think you're talking about, is that we discovered that the real pain wasn't necessarily an operational pain, but it was more just knowing a peace of mind and knowing that students are safe. So when we first started, we were just replacing clipboards with iPads, and that was just more efficient. But that wasn't really the pain, like the fundamental pain. The fundamental pain was that they wanted a better way to keep children safe, and, you know, having iPads and everyone being able to communicate in real time was a better way to do that. So it was just a shift.
And it was just, as you talk to them, you understood the, because I see it all over your site. And even as I was talking to you before we started, I noticed you say it. It's, where are the students? On your site, you say, always know where your students are, do roll call easily from anywhere, have multiple people do roll calls for regular roll call needs or in case of an emergency. I mean, you guys don't have mass shooters the way we do in the U.S., but that's the type of thing we're talking about. There's some issue going on, weather condition, some other crime. You want to know where your students are. Here's a quick way to do it. And you notice that, I'm assuming, from constant conversations with the customers.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that, you know, Kurt's done really well since we started, was we've had a direct access to support to our team through the, you know, with Intercom, but that's not a competitor to anybody you sponsor. But yeah, basically they always had direct access to us to give feedback. And so like we've always listened to our customers as much as we can. And that's actually helped us grow as business people and as a company, because we're solving a much bigger problem than we first thought.
Yeah. And they're willing to pay more for that than just saving time.
I keep thinking about that one story that I don't even know how to squeeze in properly here, except to say that there was a period where you guys were down to the last $100.
Oh, yeah.
And how did you end up at at a point where you only had $100 between the two of you?
Tell me if I'm wrong, but we did have a bit of money to go to a conference in America. Our first, I mean, we hadn't been overseas other than to Australia for me and probably for our time for you before that point. So we get to the US, we almost miss our flight from LA to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was scary, because if we did miss that, we would have been out. And then we get there and we basically just had to pay for the conference and like eat our food. And by the end of it, we just run out. I don't even think we could pay for one of our customers' dinner. We went to dinner with them, and then we were kind of like, yeah, we can pay half. and they're one of our very first American schools as well. And, like, again, very, very grateful for their help. But,
yeah.
I'm even thinking about a time when it was lower than that, where you guys didn't have enough money for food. You started looking on the floor, I think it was of an airport, looking for cash, collected whatever garbage cash you could find on the floor, took it to the McDonald's to try to buy it, and they said, I'm not taking this filthy money here. Just take your burger and go. Is that right?
Yeah, so after the whole trip, we spent all of our money on the conference, and we were at the airport waiting for our flight back to New Zealand, and we didn't have any money. And, yeah, for some reason, like, we weren't starving necessarily, but we wanted a burger, and we had no money. But for some reason, we thought that it would be a good idea to just look on the ground of the airport for loose change so that we could buy a burger. And I think that's just because just having no money, and like we were living in like shitty Airbnbs for like the whole week, and you're just not in a good mindset, I think. And you kind of think that sort of stuff is what you need to do to survive. But we did it, yeah.
Said that it was shitty mindset. That's the note that I have here from my producer. That's what you thought. Why is it bad mindset? What is it about? What's the problem about that mindset?
I mean, I think like a lot of people, well, especially with social media these days, you know, entrepreneurship is super glamorized. And I think like going into it, you think, hey, in like 2 years, you're going to be, you know, Zuckerberg or someone that's like absolutely killing it, or, you know, something like that. We're looking at Sam living in this apartment, and we're here like scrounging change in an airport in America. And so, yeah, you kind of, I mean, it makes you question, I guess, because of that, like, are we doing the right thing? Is this working? Like, what the heck? And but we were always, I don't know, pretty resourceful. So, but I guess the funny thing about that, just to add to that story, is I remember we got that change together finally, and then we gave it to the guy, and the guy didn't even count the coins. Like, he was just like, oh, I'm not going to count that. And I don't know, it was just like, that was, for me, it was like kind of a difference in the US and New Zealand mindset as well. It's like, in New Zealand, like, people, you kind of have to pay exactly what is told. Yeah. Like, there's much more flowy business kind of culture in the US. Like, that just like, I'm not going to count that. It's a waste of my time. Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to come back to that thing that you said earlier about entrepreneurship being glamorized. I remember you even told our producer, when we had just a couple of sales, we thought we were failures. When we were selling the first group of people, we thought that we weren't doing well because it seemed like everyone was getting a lot of customers so fast. And what's wrong with us for not doing that? And what you realized later on, only after you understood your business better, was actually two is a lot. Actually, it's harder to get enterprise customers, and getting a couple is a huge win. In fact, getting a little bit of progress with a couple is a huge win in enterprise. And I want to keep repeating that, because this is something that frankly has been an issue for me too. There's so many times where I think we're not doing well as a company because it seems like everyone's doing great. And then I find out actually they're not doing that great. What they're doing is a really good job of emphasizing the few things that go well, of dressing it all up. And we have to be more sane. It's great to promote. It's great to watch people who are good at promoting, but we got to keep our sanity about us. All right, for anyone who wants to go check out your website, it is boardingware.com. What you told me beginning of this story was, or before we started recording, was, hey, look, if we can inspire other New Zealanders, that would be a huge win for us. So I'm hoping there's someone out there who's from New Zealand, who's building a business, who will do for you what you guys did with Sam Ovens, which is just kind of knock on your door, get to know you guys, and then go build something and show you progress the way that you showed Sam. Cool?
Cool.
All right. And for anyone who wants to go follow up with my two sponsors, don't forget, really smart marketing automation done well. Not a lot of work. Doesn't overcomplicate things. Go check out activecampaign.com/Mixergy. And if you want to hire a developer and you don't have a friend who's going to work for you for $50 a week, check out toptal.com/Mixergy. All right, guys. Thanks so much for being on here.
Thanks, Andrew.
Bet. Bye.